was relieved and terrified in the same moment. I studied the compact defiance that made up so much of who she was. I said, "Tell me how I can help."
Handful. The night before we were to take our leave, me and Sky scurried in the dark, collecting everything together. We stole out to the stable to get Mama's quilt from the horse blankets, trekking across the workyard with the stars pouring down. We climbed up to Sarah's room from the cellar to the second floor, three trips, carrying quilts, black dresses, hats, veils, gloves, and hankies. Up and down, me and my lame foot passing right by Mrs. and Little Mrs. doors. We were in stocking feet, taking soft steps like the floor might sink. On the last trip, Sarah locked the door behind us, and I had a tarnished memory of her screening the keyhole while she taught me to read, how we whispered by the lamplight like we were doing now. I hung our dresses in her wardrobe. They fit us tailor-made. The veils were pressed perfect, and I'd sprinkled the velvet and crepe with Mrs. Lavender water so they had a white lady scent. I'd sewed pockets on the inside of the dresses to hold our money, along with Sarah's booklet, Mama's red scarf, and the address in Philadelphia where we hoped to end up. Sky said the rabbit was out foxing the fox. Sarah opened her steamer trunk, and I rested Mama's story quilt on the satin lining at the bottom. I brought the quilt with red squares and black triangles, hoping to pack it, too, the first blackbird wings I ever sewed. But now that I saw how little the trunk was, I felt bad for taking up the precious space. I said, "I can leave this behind." Sarah took it from me and laid it in the trunk. I would rather leave my dresses. They're not worth much. I knew the perils of what she was doing, same as she did. I read the papers. 20 years in prison for circulating publications of a seditious nature. 20 years for assisting a slave to escape. I watched her fold her few belongings on top of the quilts and thought, this ain't the same Sarah who left here. She had a firm look in her eye, and her voice didn't dither or hesitate like it used to. She'd been boiled down to a good, strong broth. Her hair was loose, dangling along the sides of her neck like silk vines, like the red threads I used to tie around the spirit tree. And I saw it then. The strange thing between us. Not love, is it? What is it? It was always there, a roundness in my chest, a pincushion. It pricked and fastened. Those girls on the roof with the tea gone cold in the cup. She brought down the lid on the trunk. I told Sky, "Go on down to the cellar and rest, and I'll be there in a while." I had one task left to do by myself. Then I eased down the stairs, out the back door, and loped off with my cane to the spirit tree. Under the branches, the moonlight splattered on me from the leaves. I felt the owls blink and the wind draw a breath. When I looked back at the house, there was Mama in the upstairs window looking down, waiting to throw me a taffy. She was standing out in the ruts of the carriageway with her leg hitched up behind her and the strap round her neck. She sat quiet against the tree trunk with sewing in her lap. I bent down and gathered up a handful of clippings from the tree, acorns, twigs, a tired dog-eared leaf, and stuffed them inside my neck pouch. Then I took my spirit. Next morning, we acted same as always. Sky went to the vegetable garden with the picking basket and plucked the ripe tomatoes and lettuce tops. Mrs. had me rubbing her ivory fans with sandpaper to scrub off the yellow tint. I worked in the alcove with the scrape of the paper, eyeing the steamship. The water on the harbor was ruffling like dress flounces. Sarah was down the hallway in the withdrawing room with Mrs. having her last goodbye. She wouldn't see her mama again. She knew that, and Mrs. knew that. The air in the house sounded like a long note on the harpsichord. Downstairs, Sarah's trunk was locked and ready by the front door. Everything inside, Mama's story, The Flock of Blackbirds. The chiming clock sang out. I counted the notes, 9 of them. And Sarah came out of the withdrawing room with her eyes stinging bright. I set down the ivory fans and followed her to her room, leaving the rabbit cane behind, leaning against the window. Sarah was wearing a pale gray dress with a big silver button at the collar, the same button from when she was a girl, pinning all her hopes on it. Stepping out through the gib door to the piazza, she peered over the rail at Sky in the ornament garden and gave her a wave. That meant, leave your plants and flowers and come inside. Pass by the house slaves. If little missus stops you, say Sarah summoned me. When Sky tapped on the door, I was already in my dress, my face padded with white flower gum. She smiled. She said, you look like a haint. Was anyone about? Sarah asked. Nobody but Hector. He said to tell you, Goodis gonna bring the carriage now. I did up the back of Sky's dress and helped her paint her face, and nobody spoke a word. Sarah's brow was furrowed tight. She walked to and fro across the room, a drawstring purse swinging on her arm. We tugged on our gloves, we fixed on our hats, we drew the veils down to our waists. The tiny bottles of oleander juice we tucked inside our sleeves. Sarah didn't need to know about that. From behind the veil, the room looked faint like the haze before daybreak. I heard the horse clop along the side of the house, coming from the workyard, and my stomach tipped. I tried not to set my heart too high, tried not to think about the free black woman up north wanting to take us in, the attic in their house with the chimney running through it, but I couldn't hold back anymore. We could help them with their school and with making their hats. I could sew quilts to sell. Sky could make a garden. Sarah handed me her mama's gold-tipped cane. Then she looked us over and said, I wouldn't know you on the street. We went swift down the staircase. If little missus happened by, then she happened by. Keep going was all. Don't stop for nobody. Reaching the bottom rung, I saw the empty place where the steamer trunk sat earlier, and then Hector by the door, boring 2 holes in us with his eyes. Sarah spoke to him. Mother asked me to provide her visitors with a ride to their home. You may go. Goodis will assist us from here. Hector eased off down the passageway. That way he looked at us. Did he know? Little Missus was nowhere to be seen. We stepped through the front door and the world rushed up. I looked back at Sky and saw a trace of whiteness float behind her veil. When Goodis drew the carriage up to the Steamboat Company sign, the heat had gathered thick under our veils. Sweat rivered down our necks. Sky lifted the gullies of her skirt for some air, and the smell of lavender and body stench drifted out. Helping me from the carriage, Goodis whispered, Lord Handful, what you doing? We hadn't fooled him. And for what I knew, Hector might have figured it out too. I peered back to see if he was charging down East Bay in the sulky with little missus. I said, Goodis, I'm sorry, but we're leaving. Don't give us away. He pressed his lips together, and I felt the places on me they touched. He was the best man I knew. Without meaning for it, my heart had got tangled with his. He squeezed my hand, his face dim through the dark curtain. He said, You take care of yourself, girl. We waited for the tickets, waited to board the ship, waited for somebody to say, Who are you? When we walked across the gangplank, the breeze lifted and the boat rocked. I thought about Mrs. and her devotions. We'd been through the Bible and back with that woman. Now we were Jesus walking on water. We climbed past the trunks, barrels, bales, and crates, past the boiler to the second deck, and sat down on a bench in the salon to wait for the guard to pass through. The room was painted white with tables alongside the windows, all of them nailed to the floor. people stood in twos and threes in their best clothes, in clouds of pipe smoke, and now and then they glanced our way, curious about the black grief we wore. Sarah sat a short space apart from us and kept her head tucked low inside her bonnet. When the two guards lumbered in, I heard Skye's breath pick up. One guard patrolled the left side, one the right. They nodded at folks, making talk here and there. Looking down, I saw the toes of Skye's slave shoes sticking out from under her fine dress. The scrabble brown shoes, the scraped up sadness of them. He stopped before us. He said, "Where you traveling to?" Talking to me. My slave tongue would be like the tip of Skye's shoes giving us away. I lifted my head and looked at him. His guard cap was cocked sideways on his head. He had new blonde whiskers and green eyes. Behind him, through the smudged window, I saw the water shimmer. "Ma'am," he said. Sarah shifted on the bench. I worried she was winding up to say something, that Skye would start humming now, that the fright spring coiled inside me would break loose. Then I remembered the widow dress I was wearing. I made a sound with my lips like I was trying to give him an answer, but choking on the words, seized by my grief. And I didn't have to pretend that much. I felt sorrow for my life, for what I'd lived and seen and known, for what was lost to me, and the weeping turned real. A soft wail came from inside me, and he took a step back. He said, "I'm sorry for your loss, ma'am." As he moved on, a white drop fell from my chin, flour plopping on my skirt. The engine caught, and a shudder ran through the bench. Then came the smell of oil and spewing smoke. The passengers left the salon for the deck to wave their hankies farewell, and we went too, out where the wharf slaves were tossing the heavy ropes. Far off, the church bells rang on St. Michael's. We stood at the bow, the three of us, holding the rail tight, waiting. The gulls wheeled by, and the steamer lurched, pitching forward. When the paddle started to roll, Sarah put her hand on my arm and left it there while the city heaved away. It was the last square on the quilt. I thought of Mama then, how her bones would always be here. People say, "Don't look back. The past is past." But I would always look back. I watched Charleston fall away in the morning light. When we left the mouth of the harbor, the wind swelled and the veils round us flapped, and I heard the blackbird wings. We rowed onto the shining water, onto the far distance.
Author's note. Hi, I'm Sue Monk-Kidd. In 2007, I traveled to New York to see Judy Chicago's The Dinner Party at the Brooklyn Museum. At the time, I was in the midst of writing a memoir, Traveling with Pomegranates, with my daughter, Ann Kidd Taylor, and I wasn't thinking about my next novel. I had no idea what it might be about, only a vague notion that I wanted to write about two sisters. Who those sisters were, when and where they lived, and what their story might be had not yet occurred to me. The Dinner Party is a monumental piece of art celebrating women's achievements in Western civilization. Chicago's banquet table, with its succulent place settings honoring 39 female guests of honor, rests upon a porcelain-tiled floor inscribed with the names of 999 other women who have made important contributions to history. It was while reading those 999 names on the heritage panels in the biographic gallery that I stumbled upon those of Sarah and Angelina Grimke, sisters from Charleston, South Carolina, the same city in which I then lived. How could I have not heard of them? Leaving the museum that day, I wondered if I'd discovered the sisters I wanted to write about. Back home in Charleston, as I began to explore their lives, I became passionately certain. As it turned out, I'd been driving by the Grimke sisters' unmarked house for over a decade, unaware these two women were the first female abolition agents and among the earliest major American feminist thinkers. Sarah was the first woman in the United States to write a comprehensive feminist manifesto, and Angelina was the first woman to speak before a legislative body. In the late 1830s, they were arguably the most famous as well as the most infamous women in America, yet they seemed only marginally known, even in the city of their origins. My ignorance of them felt like both a personal failing and a confirmation of Chicago's view that women's achievements had been repeatedly erased through history. Sarah and Angelina were born into the power and wealth of Charleston's aristocracy, a social class that derived from English concepts of landed gentry. They were ladies of piety and gentility who moved in the elite circles of society, and yet few 19th century women ever misbehaved so thoroughly. They underwent a long, painful metamorphosis, breaking from their family, their religion, their homeland, and their traditions, becoming exiles and eventually pariahs in Charleston. 15 years before Harriet Beecher Stowe wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin, which was wholly influenced by American Slavery as It Is, a pamphlet written by Sarah Angelina and Angelina's husband, Theodore Weld, and published in 1839, the Grimke sisters were out crusading not only for the immediate emancipation of slaves, but for racial equality, an idea that was radical even among abolitionists. And 10 years before the Seneca Falls Convention, initiated by Lucretia Mott and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, the Grimkes were fighting a bruising battle for women's rights, taking the first blows of backlash. As I read about the sisters, I was drawn more and more to Sarah and what she'd overcome. Before stepping onto the public stage, she experienced intense longings for a vocation, crushed hopes, betrayal, unrequited love, loneliness, self-doubt, ostracism, and suffocating silence. It seemed to me she had invented her wings not so much in spite of these things, but because of them. What compelled me as much as her life as a reformer was her life as a woman. How did she become who she was? My aim was not to write a thinly fictionalized account of Sarah Grimke's history, but a thickly imagined story inspired by her life. During my research, delving into diaries, letters, speeches, newspaper accounts, and Sarah's own writing, as well as a huge amount of biographical material, I formed my own understanding of her desires, struggles, and motivations. The voice and inner life I've given Sarah are my own interpretation. I've attempted to remain true to the broad historical contours of Sarah's life. I've included in these pages most of her significant events and formative experiences, along with an enormous amount of factual detail. Occasionally, I've used Sarah's own words from her writings. Her letters in the novel, however, are my own invention. The most expansive and notable way that I've diverged from Sarah's record is through her imaginary relationship with the fictional character of Hetty Handful. From the moment I decided to write about Sarah Grimke, I felt compelled to also create the story of an enslaved character, giving her a life and a voice that could be entwined with Sarah's. I felt I couldn't write the novel otherwise, that both of their worlds would have to be represented here. Then I came upon a tantalizing detail. As a girl, Sarah was given a young slave named Hetty to be her waiting maid. According to Sarah, they became close, defying the laws of South Carolina and her own jurist father, who helped to write those laws. Sarah taught Hetty to read, for which they were both severely punished. There, however, ends the short narrative of Hetty